Chapter 6. The early morning street was damp, and over all the houses was a fog, wet enough to start drops slipping across the upright surfaces. Nobody was out, but occasional yellow rectangles were kitchens in which, Jim Ferguson imagined, men stood before open ovens with their rumps to the heat. He shaved and fried some mush left over from the day before, drank gritty, dark coffee that had been standing in the pot, and then, with his overcoat around him, he descended the stairs to the basement garage in which his Pontiac was parked. Lydia was asleep. No one heard him. No one saw him go. Moisture had gotten into the engine, and it died twice as he backed the car from the garage. Its hollow coughing continued as he drove down Grove Street, and he could not help thinking that had he had the time, he would take the car entirely apart. Almost everything in it was worn, nothing engaged. He did not shift into high gear, but remained in second until he reached a stoplight. There he looked carefully and, without stopping, turned right. Soon he was driving at 35 miles an hour through Oakland. By the time he had gone a mile, the engine had warmed and was working a little better. He put on the radio and listened to a program of the Sons of the Pioneers. Most of the drivers along East Shore Freeway had in mind the idea of going to San Francisco. Traffic was heavy facing him, but his own lanes were open as he continued toward Richmond. The windows of the Pontiac were up, and the heater was on. He felt comfortable and sleepy, and the cowboy music lulled him. Gradually he let the car slide from its lane, and then, as a car behind him honked, he drew himself up on the seat and concentrated. The time was 6:30. Along the flat shoreline of the East Bay on his right ran the aquatic park. He had by this time reached a speed of 60 miles an hour, and that seemed to him plenty. Apparently he had not been this way in more time than he realized. There were changes in the freeway, new overhead ramps being built, detours and cutoffs which confused him. And already, he noticed, the freeway was 12 lanes wide. Did they have to make it even wider? The pavement was white cement and there were no stops. The flatness of the pavement pleased him. He held the wheel with both hands and gazed at the houses and hills to his right. Now the problem came of finding Hoffman Boulevard. He had to get over to the right, or he would not be able to leave the freeway, so he drifted gradually, thinking that this was the best way. Cars on his right, however, did not think so. A chorus of horns jolted him. Gunning the car forward, he shot into an open space in the right-hand lane, almost the asphalt shoulder. A moment later, his car coasted along the narrow, bumpy, temporary start of Hoffman. He shot past a green light at an intersection and under an ominous black iron overpass with huge warning signs and winking yellow lights. The lights alternated in a pattern that made him feel as he drove beneath them that something terrible was going to happen. The passage under the overpass was so narrow that for a moment he thought the car would not make it. He had the illusion that he would scrape on both sides, and it was all he could do to keep his hands on the steering wheel. But already he'd come out on the far side. There, once more, was the bay to his left. Several miles later, Hoffman entered a strip of cut-rate gasoline stations and truck drivers' cafes, and then the worst section of run-down Negro shacks that he could recall. Traffic moved very slowly, with huge diesel trucks interspersed among the cars. This, he understood, was Richmond. Trash littered the broken sidewalks. To his left, he saw factories and wharves. Near the water, he realized, train tracks, one after another. And then, ahead, a steep hill with houses. The street turned sharply. He saw an open place and then the immense Standard Oil refinery. All at once, the street became a freeway again, climbing, with the cars picking up speed on all sides of him. He whizzed along a broad curve above the refinery, and now he saw the bay once more and the bridge that connected the East Bay to Marin County. It was the ugliest bridge he had ever seen, but it did not depress him. Instead, it made him laugh. He slowed at the toll plaza of the bridge, paid his 75 cents, and then found himself on the bridge. They had built it so that the driver could see nothing, no water, none of the islands, not even his destination. All he could pick out were the heavy metal rails. "What genius," he said to himself. "What planning." Again he laughed. At last one sight became obvious. He fastened his gaze on it, far ahead. San Quentin Prison. Clay-colored buildings like some old Mexican fort spread out at the water's edge, all in very good shape. The bridge passed to the right of the prison and led him off on a wide freeway which led into one cut-off after another. Again he was confused, but a sign told him which cut-off to take to get back onto U.S. 101 North, and so he took that. He sped across a flat plain at enormous speed, a car behind him and another ahead. Wind whipped at his Pontiac. There was San Rafael and U.S. 101. He had almost arrived, and it had not taken very long. He was well ahead of schedule, and his spirits rose even further. When he saw a gas station on a little side cut-off road, he made a signal and coasted from the freeway. After several turns, he found himself at the gas station. Leaving the road, he brought the car to the nearest island of pumps. The morning air, as he opened the car door, was warm. Wind riffled the stalks of weeds growing in the surrounding fields. He lifted the hood and, with a page of newspaper, took an oil reading. The oil level was down, so he picked up a quart of 30 weight from the rack by the pumps. The boyish attendant in his white uniform was hurrying over as the old man emptied the oil into the pouring can that had been put nearby.
"Hey!" the boy said indignantly. "None of that!"
"Sorry," Ferguson said, remembering now that he was not in his own garage. "Give me five of the regular." He had already begun to reach for the gas hose, but he pretended that he'd been reading the price. Ethyl was 39 cents a gallon. He showed amazement at the amount as the boy lifted down the hose. The boy was still upset. As he walked to the rear of the car and removed the gas cap, he watched the old man as if expecting him to tinker again with the company's property. Self-consciously, the old man got back inside the car and remained there until the boy came around to wash the windshield. "No, no, no," he said to the boy, wanting to leave, pushing several $1 bills at him. The boy gave him change and retrieved the pouring can. The hood slammed down, and the old man drove from the station back onto the road. There a milk truck honked at him as he pulled in front of it. As he drove, his eagerness increased. Now, at any time, he might see the sign leading to Marin County Gardens. But he had left the freeway. The little road did not lead back to it, but brought him out on a residential street. A huge wire cyclone fence separated him from the freeway, and beyond the fence, cars shot along at enormous speed. However, he continued on with no diminution of spirits, disconnected from the freeway as he was. Evidently, he had entered San Rafael, a town to which he rarely, if ever, came. Between silent houses, he drove at 25 miles an hour. The blocks were short. A number of men could be seen on their way to work, walking rapidly, some wearing suits, others in work clothes. They all had a speeded-up motion, as in an old film. That amused him, too. For a time, he drove through the town, still keeping in sight of the freeway, wondering where he was, but enjoying himself. And then, at last, he sighted something heartening. The broken-up expanse of new dirt, which, he realized, was construction beyond the freeway. Great culverts lying in rows, the ceramic drainage system which would go down first before anything else, and parked machinery, big ones, the major equipment which the federal government used in its work. He had seen them when Highway 40 had been rebuilt, the East Shore Freeway. He came then to the very edge of the construction zone and halted his car. He had no choice but to halt. The pavement ended in a series of jagged projections that had already cracked. The road on which he drove had been scooped away by the digging equipment. He saw down into a drop-off, dirt only, the underneath part, which they usually never got to see. It frightened him, and he pulled on the handbrake. Machines, he thought, had carried away everything here, had left nothing at all. What power to remove! Nothing could stand. He looked to the right and left, furrow for a long way, and so goddamn wide. Did cars go across? Could one go and rejoin the freeway on the far side? He saw high up tiny swift dots. Cars on the freeway. Parallel to the freeway ran a double track. Treadmarks in the dirt imprinted by pressure. Some vehicles. So he started up the car and drove down, off the asphalt. The car bumped, creaked, lifted on first one side and then the other. He drove carefully along the rutted tracks. The car shuddered as stones broke beneath the wheels. He gripped the steering wheel and eased the car into holes and out again. Once he passed workmen who gaped at him. Then he passed mounds of machines, and at last he saw a metallic bulk approaching him head-on. He stopped the car as the object became a bulldozer. The driver, perched high up in his seat, shook his fist and shouted. He, too, stopped, and the two vehicles faced each other. Ferguson did not get out. He remained behind the wheel. The driver of the bulldozer jumped down and walked over.
Who the hell are you? Get this heap out of here!
To Ferguson, the bulldozer and the angry driver were unreal. He heard the man panting and saw his red face moon up at the window, but still he did not stir. He did not know what to do.
Get back! The man shouted. Get back to the road! Come on, fella!
Ferguson said, you know, Mr. Bradford.
Other workmen arrived, and with them was a man in a business suit. They pointed at Ferguson's Pontiac and waved more workmen to follow. A line of figures grew alongside the rise of equipment and dirt. Onlookers. The man in the business suit came to the window and said,
I'll have to ask you to back your car the way you came. This is a private road for use by the state.
Ferguson could think of nothing to say. He had come almost a mile along the rutted tracks in low gear. The idea of backing bewildered him. He felt confused, and he could not speak.
What's the matter with them?
The driver was yelling.
Christ, I have to get by. I can't fart around here.
A workman said,
Maybe he doesn't speak English. Let me see your driver's license, the man in the business suit said.
No,
Ferguson said. A workman said,
He don't know how to back out.
Move over, the man in the business suit said. He opened the car door. I'll back it. Move over, buddy. Look, we can give you a citation. You're on state property. You're a trespasser. You have no legal right to be on this road. It isn't a road. It's a construction project.
He pushed Ferguson over, slammed the door, and putting the Pontiac into reverse and peering over his shoulder, began to back. The driver returned to his bulldozer and followed. It took a long time to reach the point at which the genuine road had ceased. Ferguson gazed at the floorboards and said nothing.
Okay, the man said, tugging on the parking brake and stepping out. It's all yours.
How do I go?
Ferguson said. Back, up the rise, the way you came.
Ferguson pointed across the expanse of dirt at the freeway on the far side.
Go back, the man repeated. Back to San Rafael and find a street to cross there.
He walked rapidly off, and Ferguson was alone. He could hear the rumble of the bulldozer and the sounds of the workmen. They were starting their day. Shifting into gear, the teeth clashed. He drove clumsily back along the road and once again found himself in the residential section of San Rafael, among the houses and lawns. When he saw a man walking along the sidewalk, Ferguson leaned out the window and called,
How do I get across?
The man glanced at him and went on without speaking. Ferguson rolled up the window again. He felt shaken and depressed, and he did not pursue the man. The time was now 9 o'clock, and the sky was warming. Yellow sunlight hung over the trees and sidewalks. The lawn sparkled. A mailman walked slowly along, and Ferguson brought the car to the curb beside him.
"How do I get across 101?
He said. "Where do you want to go?"
"Marin County Gardens,"
he said, resting a little as he sat behind the steering wheel. The mailman consulted with himself.
"No,"
he said. "I never heard of it. Go down to the city hall and ask them. Ask somebody down there. They'll know," he continued on. From then on, the old man drove aimlessly, not knowing where to go or whom to talk to. He seemed to be getting farther and farther away from the main part of town. The streets became steeper and the houses older. At last he came out into what seemed to be a housing tract, but an old one. The houses were decayed and the weeds high in the yards. Once he saw a policeman, but the policeman looked tough and unsympathetic, so he did not stop there either. The time was now 10:15. "Oh, this is a hell of a thing," he thought to himself. "Where am I? Still in San Rafael?" He saw, past the tract, what appeared to be a glimpse of open country, fields, hills, far off. At 10:30, he came to an intersection at which was a small imitation stone building with a sign over it. Dowland Real Estate Notary Public Rentals. So he parked the car and went inside. Behind one of the three desks sat a middle-aged woman in a print dress, wearing a hat and talking on the phone. She smiled at him, concluded her conversation, and then came over to the counter. "Good morning," she said. Ferguson said, "I want to go to Marin County Gardens." The woman pondered. She seemed well-groomed, with gray hair pulled back and waved. Her clothes looked expensive, and she smelled of powder and perfume. "That's not ours," she said. "That's one of the new sub-developments on the far side of 101. Hesitating, she said, "I, frankly, don't even know if they're showing yet."
"I want to see Mr. Bradford," he said.
The woman leaned against the counter and tapped at her teeth with a yellow lead pencil.
"You can double back for a mile or so and then get across, or you can go on. Your subdevelopment is up the highway toward Petaluma, so you might as well go that way. They're working all around there. You really should be careful. It's easy to get lost."
By bringing a map to the counter, she was able to give him directions that he could make out. He thanked her and returned to his car, feeling new confidence. Maybe now, he thought. At least it did exist. She had recognized the name. Once more he was in motion, and again in the area of construction work. The road became a tangle of dirt and asphalt, broken down, he decided, by heavy equipment. But it did cross the highway, and he reached the far side, flagged by an old man in blue jeans, along with a group of other cars. There he was sent left along a pitted old blacktop road that followed the course of the freeway, but perhaps a mile to its left. On each side of him were orchards of dead fruit trees. He could not tell what sort they had been. To his ears came the racket of machinery. Now he saw them, far off, like toiling insects. But he thought now, really thought, that he could see Marin County Gardens. At least there was some sort of new housing development going up the side of a broad brown hill. He could make out where the ground had been cleared, new narrow roads put in, foundations begun. Feeling buoyed up, he rolled the car windows down and let the warm summer air into the car, the dry country air, so different from the cities. The smell of drying grass seemed satisfying, and the sight of the flat fields gave him the absolute conviction that he had finally found it. The view which he now saw through his dust and bug-spattered windshield exactly fitted his expectations. Now, to his delight, the sign itself appeared. As he passed, he made out only the larger words. The information painted on the wood in blazing green and red dwindled row by row into facts about down payments, floor plans, number of bricks in the fireplace, colors. He read, "Marin County Gardens, only 1/4 mile ahead, open for public inspection." This no longer was a state or federal construction project. This area of dirt and machines ahead, this was a private business enterprise. And yet it fitted in. It was part of the general stirring, the activity. All joined, and here his part entered. Here he fitted in. His wrists and hands burned with perspiration. He blinked and felt a new kind of feeling, or rather an old one, left over from his childhood. He yearned to spill from the car and get his feet onto the ground. He wanted to run and leap and grab up things to throw. The road led to a small building with tar paper roof and parking lot before it. A single, dingy, black Ford was parked there. The ground was muddy and trampled. He saw several rows of roofing paper stacked up beside the small building, and a half-empty cement sack. When he had parked and put on the handbrake, he made himself act methodically. He walked to the building with slow, easy steps. The door was open to an office in which a man sat behind a desk with his feet up and crossed. He was reading a paperback book. The office smelled of varnish. On the desk were a telephone and wire baskets of papers, and on one wall was a glossy calendar, new and crisp, with a print of a girl in a long flowered skirt. "Greetings," the man said. He turned the pages of his book as if discarding the unread part. Then he tossed it down on the desk loudly and folded his hands. He was young, with a long horse face and thick hair. His suit was informal, single-breasted. His teeth projected, and the skin of his neck was red and rough. Surprisingly, his socks hung in folds around his ankles. "You read these things?" he said, pointing with his thumb at the closed paperback book.
"No,"
Ferguson said, panting with exertion and excitement. The man picked up the book and regarded it.
"Brainwave," he said, "by Powell Anderson. Science fiction. I read all these science fiction books. I must have read 50 the last month or so. The desk's full of them. People give them to me. I don't have to buy them."
Ferguson, with his urgency, had arrived at this little closed spot of timelessness. The gigantic public works, protracted over decades, were unfolding close to this office and man. He had taken on their viewpoint. At his desk, with his heap of books, he was an Egyptian officer, emotionless, cut off. He greeted Ferguson ponderously.
"No," Ferguson said, wanting to bring the man back into motion, back into time. "Say, do you know Mr. Bradford?"
The man nodded.
"Is he here?"
"Bradford isn't here,"
the man said. He rose to his feet and extended his hand, which Ferguson found heavy and dry. The man stooped from the low ceiling of the office, and his height had gone into his shoulders.
"My name is Carmichael. What is your name?"
He asked it with a rising inflection, as if he had known it and forgotten it and expected to recognize it once he heard it repeated again.
"Jim Ferguson."
"Hello, Jim,"
Carmichael said, twisting his head on an angle and squinting.
"Is that an Irish name?"
"I guess so,"
Ferguson said. He was calming now, feeling his blood pressure wane.
"Sit down, Jim."
Carmichael pushed a chair out and returned to his own chair facing across the desk. His two flinty hands rubbed together, upright, forming a vertical surface. Then, with his thumbnail, he tugged down his lip and pried at his gum.
"Well, Jim," he said, "what can I do for you? Can I sell you a house?"
"No," Ferguson said. "I want to talk to Mr. Bradford. I have something to discuss. When is he here?"
"You do not want to buy a house," Carmichael said. "I didn't think you wanted to buy a house, actually. Mr. Bradford came out here once that I know of. Actually, Bradford is part of the financial bunch that backs this place. The work is done by Gross and Duncan. Contractors."
His voice slowed.
I represent the company, so you can talk to me.
Ferguson had decided that he would not give himself away, that he would pretend to be something else and not what he really was. He really was here to see what had been accomplished. He was passing judgment on Marin County Gardens and the work and schemes of its backers. In him was the capacity to decide not merely about himself, but about them all. And Carmichael was in on it because he was being decided about. He was part of the subdivision and the new shopping center, as were the workmen with the bulldozer and the man in the business suit who had backed the Pontiac, and in a way the policeman and the mailman and the real estate woman and all the rest of them.
"I want to see what they're doing," Ferguson said. "Can we look?"
"Why not?"
Carmichael said, making no move to get up. He seemed resigned and pleasant, but not particularly involved.
"What line of work are you in, Jim?"
"Mechanics," Ferguson said.
"What do you do, design or invent or make machines? You work with machines?"
"Cars," Ferguson said.
"Do you?"
Carmichael seemed interested.
"I used to have a souped-up buggy I worked on. During the war, I was in the CBs. I had some engine designs I worked up, mostly carburetor changes. Feed for each cylinder. That's why I read this stuff."
He picked up his science fiction book and dropped it flat to the desk again.
"You know, these guys who write these things, these rocket ships and time travel machines and faster than light drives, all that stuff, if you want the hero to be on Mars, you say something like, 'He turned on the automatic high-gain propulsion tubes.' This one isn't so bad, but some of them are. They go barreling around the universe. It must be easy to write this stuff. They must bat it out."
"I see,"
Ferguson said, not following the man's talk.
"I'd like to meet one of these science fiction boys. I'd hire myself out as a technical consultant."
Carmichael's great horse teeth showed in irony.
10 or 15% of the price he gets. This stuff is just fake. They fake it as they go along. This one here," he said, lifting the book around so that Ferguson could see it, "this is about the IQ of everybody going up overnight."
He laughed suddenly, a loud, startling noise.
"Animals become as smart as people. You ever read this stuff?"
"No,"
Ferguson said. He was impatient to go on. He walked to the door of the office and looked out at the half-completed houses.
"Well, what do you do with cars?"
Carmichael asked from the desk. "Fix them. I have a garage in Oakland."
"What part of Oakland?"
"San Pablo Avenue," he said, and opened the door to go outside. Carmichael pushed back his chair and followed after him. His hand descended on Ferguson's shoulder.
"You say you want to go look around."
He started down the gravel path beside Ferguson.
"Well, I'll show you around."
"Thanks," Ferguson said.
Straining, he saw the flat tract at the bottom of the hill. A muddy path went down and across a deep ditch, past heaps of pipe and piled lumber. Separate crews worked laying foundations. A cement mixer churned, and the echoing racket of a hammer stirred the midday air. The air smelled of fresh-cut wood.
"Pretty nice,"
Carmichael said, stopping to light a cigarette. He tossed the match a long distance off.
"Don't you think so, Jim?"
"Yes,"
Ferguson said. They worked their way down the path. Under their feet, clumps of dirt rolled, and Ferguson tottered as his heels slid in the ooze.
"Watch your step,"
Carmichael said from behind him. He himself descended with calm.
"No, Bradford doesn't come out here. You see, Jim, I'll tell you how this thing works. Bradford has nothing to do with the building. They put up the money, and Gross and Duncan do the work. The selling is handled by two or three agents. Now, the deal I have is, I live here on the tract. I get one of the houses rent-free for the first year or until the tract fills up. For each house I sell, I get a flat $500. Other than that, I get no salary. But all I have to do is sell 2 houses a month. And you can see my house. It's a show house, full of department store furniture and an electric kitchen, completely equipped. My wife's there.
He pointed, and Ferguson could see curtains in the windows of the house. It was a 1-story California ranch-style house with a garage and a picket fence and a lawn bordered by flowers. The cement walk led to the mire of dirt that was the street. All the other houses were unfinished, unpainted, and empty. Their skeletons were identical. He saw no variation along the rows.
"There's 4 different styles, Carmichael said. "But right now you can't see the difference. It's in the color and the lattice work and the number of bedrooms."
"I see," Ferguson said.
"Over there will be the shopping center," Carmichael gestured. "That's a separate enterprise. They think it's too much of a gamble. They want it operated on its own. They're sure the houses will go, but the shopping center is something else."
"Why?"
Ferguson said. "People have to buy, and they live out here."
"They live here," Carmichael agreed. "But did you ever see a woman that wanted to buy near home? The ladies want to go into town. They won't buy here. They'll drive to San Francisco. It'll give them an excuse to go to the big downtown department stores. Maybe a food market here, a market and a gas pump and a lunch counter. But they're talking in terms of," he spread his arms, "bakeries and pottery shops and circulating library and shoe repair."
"A town," Ferguson said. Carmichael glanced at him.
"The works." "Yes."
"You don't think it'll pay?"
"Well, they don't need it."
"They're not risking anything."
"No, they'll leave it on its own. If it sinks, they'll be free."
"The garage," Ferguson said. "I was thinking about buying into that."
Carmichael was still looking at him, and Ferguson knew that he had been figured out from the start. The man had appraised him. That was his job. Ferguson walked across the flat ground. When he reached a group of workmen, he halted. They were setting frames for concrete to be poured for the foundations of the house.
"Well," Carmichael said beside him, "it would cost you 40 or 50.
"Yes," Ferguson said.
"What about this garage in Oakland?"
"I sold it. I'm selling it."
"Why?"
Ferguson did not answer. He felt tense and disturbed, and he walked away from Carmichael with his hands in his pockets. After a while, Carmichael followed him.
"Let's go back to the office," he said. "We can talk."
Ferguson said, "What do you get for these?"
He meant the houses.
12 or 14.
"They're good. Nothing special, but they're well built. Gross and Duncan know their business. Nobody's getting swindled."
Carmichael ground his cigarette out in the mushy soil.
"At one time I was thinking about the auto thing. The supply shop. Me, I mean. But they want people to buy in to get in on that. I couldn't raise that. When they talk that kind of money, I'm out. They're sound enough on this auto business. The people who live this far out won't be getting into town for their auto parts and work. They'll have it done here because when they need it, they'll need it right away."
"That's what I figured," Ferguson said, and he thought then of something else. "The women won't be going to the garage. The men bring in the car."
"How long have you been in the garage business?"
"Most of my life."
"How do you like it?"
"It's okay." He felt impatient. "A lot of hard work, crawling under cars."
"You like what you see here?"
"Yes," he said.
"It's a damn funny thing," Carmichael said. "Come on, let's go back."
He guided Ferguson with his arm, and the two men walked toward the ditch and the rise.
"People come out here, drive all the way from the city. They know it isn't finished. They know the freeway isn't done and the houses aren't either. And when they get out here, they look around and bellyache like hell." What do they want, for Christ's sake? I can see this place. All you have to do is look. In 2 or 3 years, this will be lawns and wives out watering and kids crawling everywhere. What do they need? These places look alike. So what? They won't look alike when people get in them. It's the people that makes them look different. You take any 6 blocks of empty houses, it's scary. The people bring in the personal furniture and hangings.
How many houses have you sold?
Ferguson said.
6, 7.
There's other salesmen back in the city.
They crossed the ditch and halted so that Ferguson could get his breath.
Would you bring anybody else in with you?
Carmichael asked.
No.
He was panting again with the exertion of climbing. To excuse himself, he looked back at the houses to see them once more before they took the rise.
I could run it alone, the financial part.
But you'd hire mechanics.
Yes,
Ferguson said.
You're married? You have a family?
Yes,
he said. Carmichael started leisurely up the hillside, and Ferguson followed. The old man's shoes disappeared into the yellow clay and the grass. As he clutched for support, slid through his fingers. Carmichael climbed upright with ease and sureness, talking slowly.
It would be up to you. There's no reason why it wouldn't work out. They have a mint tied up in this place, and it's all geared in with the freeway. They know approximately when they should have most of the houses sold. You'd start by getting a return on your investment right from the start anyhow, because there are a lot of other tracks around here, a lot of them filled, and the people coming down from Petaluma, and on weekends this is busy with traffic going up to the Russian River. You saw the number of cars on 101. This is a busy area, and getting more busy all the time. What else can it do but grow?
Jim Ferguson climbed with effort. Ahead of him, Carmichael talked on, and he listened as best he could. His hands were wet, and they stung from the edges of the grass. At one point, he stumbled and fell against the dirt. His fingers dug and floundered, and he shut his eyes. Carmichael was at the top and going on, slowing because he saw that the old man was not up with him. Ferguson stood up and stepped widely to finish in 3 last strides. At the top was a collection of steel support bars, and as he reached them, his toe caught in the dragging weeds that had grown across them. He stepped forward, and his body collapsed. The air rushed out of him, and he fell into darkness, fell so suddenly that he could say nothing. It was as if the ground had magnetized him. He went over on his face like metal, with his arms out. He did not feel the ground come up, and he did not hear himself fall. One moment he was laboriously climbing behind Carmichael, and then he lay face down in the ooze. Carmichael, still talking, walked a few paces. He said, "Oh, hell," and came back, bending with his placid horse face dipping toward Ferguson. The old man felt his presence and grunted, wanting to lift himself, but he couldn't. He had no strength. A distant humming was all he could hear, and although he could remember Carmichael's voice, he could not really catch the sound of it. Taking hold of the old man's arm, Carmichael tried to lift him. He lifted with both hands, but Ferguson did not budge. Carmichael could not budge him, and Ferguson felt his own weight, heavy and dead, snapped tight by the magnetic ground. He had been snared, and he could do and say nothing. He could only wait. He hoped that Carmichael would have an answer.
"Hey!"
Carmichael said to some workmen along the hillside.
"Give me a hand!"
The workman walked over. Ferguson did not feel foolish or frightened. He felt a little sick at his stomach, and now his chest was beginning to hurt. He could, with his mind, trace the outline of the steel support bars. They were under him. The pressure became pain, and he winced.
"What happened?"
a workman said.
"He fell,"
Carmichael said. They lifted the old man to his feet. They tipped him back to a standing position. Ferguson found himself upright, dripping mud and crushed weeds. The pressure remained on his chest, however. He lifted his hand and brushed reflexively. His face seemed puffy and leaking, as if it were drizzling blood.
"Thanks," Carmichael said. The workman went off. "Hey," he said to Ferguson, "you really took a spill."
Ferguson nodded. The pain in his chest numbed him. He touched himself with his stiff fingers, but he felt nothing at all. He could not talk, either. Now he was frightened.
"Let's go into the office," Carmichael said.
With his hand on Ferguson's shoulder, he walked him toward the tar-paper-roofed shack.
"How about a cup of coffee?"
"No,"
Ferguson said. His voice sounded a long way from him and discordant, as if he were hearing it through a wire.
"I have to get back."
"You want to get into your car?"
Ferguson nodded, and Carmichael walked with him to the parked Pontiac. Carmichael opened the door, and the old man got in behind the wheel. He leaned back against the upholstery and sucked in huge gusts of air. The air hurt his throat, as if it, too, were skinned by the fall. He held his hand against his chest and pushed in.
"How do you feel?"
Carmichael said. He nodded.
"You have to watch that wet dirt. It's tricky."
"Yes," Ferguson said.
His head was beginning to clear and he could see, but he felt so sick that he knew he had broken something inside. He was trembling and scared, and he wished Carmichael would leave. He wanted to go back to Oakland. Carmichael, leaning by the car door, was talking at great length, continuing his discussion as if nothing had happened. His infinite calm had not been broken. The old man had fallen, and Carmichael had arranged to get him back on his feet. The old man perspired as he lay against the upholstery of his car, and he thought about driving back. He was sure he could do it. He could, if necessary, pull off the road. He wanted to leave right now, and he opened his eyes and interrupted.
"Thanks, Mr. Carmichael. I'll see you."
With his right hand, he put on the ignition, and with his foot, he pushed down on the gas. The motor started.
"Wait," Carmichael said. "I'll give you my card."
Ferguson accepted the card and put it in his pocket. He let the car go forward a yard, and Carmichael walked along beside it. Staring through the windshield, Ferguson blinked as sweat got into his eyebrows and down into his eyes. The pain was more intense, less dull. He felt it locate itself in his heart, and suddenly he understood that he had had a heart attack. Not much of one, a small one, from the climbing and the excitement.
"Goodbye," he said.
Nodding with the motion of the car, he drove down the road.
"I'll see you, Jim,"
Carmichael said. He was lost to Ferguson's sight. The sound of his voice dwindled. Ferguson drove with both hands clutching the wheel. When he had gone a mile or so, he slowed and lay back again, trying to make himself comfortable. The pain seemed to be fading. He was glad of that. By the time he had found his way back onto the highway, he was able to sit up entirely. The cramp or pain was fading. Trembling, he shifted for the first time into high gear. The roar of the engine subsided. He was still frightened, and as he drove, he sang to himself. Boom, 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 boom. It meant nothing, and he had never made sounds like that before. With his lips, he repeated the sounds again and again, as if they were important. Boom, boom, boom. He was relieved to see San Rafael on both sides of the highway, because that meant he would soon be on the bridge and going back across to the East Bay. Boom, 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 he said to himself, hearing his own voice. He gained strength and said it louder. The midday sun was hot, and it made perspiration steam down his cheeks and into his collar. His coat stuck against him, and when he moved, he felt the sticky plucking of fabric. Perhaps, he thought, his chest had been laid open by the steel beams.